Earlier this week, Public Address's Keith Ng filed a fascinating and alarming story from the Sri Lankan coastal town of Batticaloa, which is thronged with tens of thousands of new refugees driven into camps by the resurgence of a decades-old civil war. It's a story you may have missed, because although UNICEF and a number of NGOs are there, journalists largely are not. Keith, this is a war that most of us thought had gone. When did it flare up and why?
Well, technically, it hasn't flared up because technically the 2002 Norwegian brokered ceasefire is still in place. So really, there is supposedly no war going on, but the government has started shelling areas that are controlled by the LTTE that were given to it under the 2002 ceasefire agreement, and they're trying to drive the LTTE out of these areas. And of course, the LTTE are retaliating, but even before all this happened, the low-level violence in terms of abductions and killings and intimidation was happening across the country, across the north and eastern parts of the country.
Now, when you say the LTTE, you're talking about the Tamil separatists?
Yes, the Tamil Tigers. They're fighting for an independent state within Sri Lanka for the Tamil ethnic groups. But since its original conception around 2 decades ago, what's happened is that the eastern, because there were originally eastern and northern divisions between Tamil groups, the eastern group has broken off into what's now known as the Karuna faction. So right now there are actually three parties in this conflict. That's the government's army, the Sri Lankan army, and the LTTE, that's also called Tamil Tigers, as well as the Karuna faction.
Right, so although this is a conflict that goes back to the 1950s, we're not talking about precisely the same factions today then?
Well, the Karuna faction really is the only new one here. Well, the LTTE started, I believe, about 20 years ago, about 2 decades ago. And so that conflict has really been ongoing for these last 20 years.
And from your story that we published this week, I get the impression that the Karuna faction is in a slightly unusual position. It seems to be tacitly left alone by the government for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because the Karuna faction has been accused of a lot of human rights abuses, such as, in particular, the worst one, of course, is child recruitment, and, of course, the other ones that are supposedly not as bad, abductions and killings and intimidation of the community. And, of course, these guys, the Karuna faction, are operating in Batticaloa, which is a district controlled by government troops. And when I was there, what you can see is normal soldiers, uniformed men with assault rifles walking around, and they would walk right past these other guys that are the Karunas men that are ununiformed but still heavily armed, and they just walk right by each other. And near close to government checkpoints, you would also see the officers for the Karuna faction. You'd see that they'd have these big 10-foot logos just sticking out with a giant bright red and yellow sign saying this is the office of the Karuna faction. And so it really is extremely rich for the government to be saying that they're not letting the Karuna faction operate with impunity, because clearly the army knows exactly what the Karuna faction are up to and where they are, and they're doing nothing to stop it. Now, there are reports that the government is actually either giving arms to the Karuna faction or intelligence or actually funding them. But those haven't been confirmed. But at the very least, what we can know is that the government is allowing the Karuna faction to operate with impunity.
Is it relevant to talk about who are the good guys here? Is anyone in this conflict?
Well, it's... sure, if you're talking about the cause, you can probably make moral judgments on it. But in terms of the actual tactics and in terms of what they're actually doing, both sides are guilty of a lot of human rights violations and a lot of things that are just a lot of killings and a lot of very brutal, nasty stuff. No, I think making a moral judgment, it's very tough because as on journalists, you don't really have that much of sympathy either for the sovereign integrity of Sri Lanka as a nation or for the LTTE's notion of having an independent homeland. Those causes really have no relevance to us in the Western world. I mean, what we do care about is the fact that there are 150,000 refugees in Batticaloa right now that have been displaced from their homes, that there are people getting killed every day, that there are child soldiers that are abducted from their homes and forced to fight. These are the things that we care about. So in a sense, that's why there's a sort of a barrier between the people that are actually fighting the war and international media, because we really don't sympathize with either side.
Yeah, and as you point out in your story, the people are very much the meat in the sandwich here, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they have a strong political value. These are the refugees that we're talking about here, that when they're in LTTE territory, they're kind of human shields, that if the government tries to avoid killing civilians, then they would have to hold back on the bombing and the artillery strikes, which would give the LTTE a tactical advantage. And of course, if the government kills these people, then LTTE can go, look what the government is doing, they're killing all these people. But at the same time, the government uses these refugees as political pawns as well, that whenever there's a mass exodus of refugees, the government actually says this is a good thing. This says that, hey, look at all these people running away from the LTTE-controlled territory. You know, they neglect to mention the fact that they're running away because, you know, explosive shells are falling from the skies and blowing up their villages. But what they try to frame it as is these people are expressing a lack of confidence in the LTTE and are coming towards the safety of the government. And so these refugees know that they're caught in the middle, and they know that whatever side they're on, they're going to be used.
How is this reported within Sri Lanka itself? Is it the government line that's reported?
Well, yes. The media in Sri Lanka is pretty terrible because of a their own version of something that's a lot worse than the Patriot Act, I suppose, in terms of allowing the government to imprison people and to put clamps on the free press. So right now, the reporting that's happening in Sri Lanka is very much in the newspapers is very much pro-government, and they do neglect a lot of news. Basically, whatever they say is all they report on is the government has captured this many people, the government has had this success, and on some of the atrocities that are committed by the LTTE. On the other hand, you have websites like TamilNet, which have contributions from both from people in LTTE-controlled territory and around Sri Lanka, as well as overseas Tamils. Now, what they report is it's one of these kind of things that you pick up quite quickly. The night after the LTTE bombed the airport, they had a report up within half an hour with photos of the planes. Now, obviously, there's some connection there. So all the news sources that you get are aligned with one side or the other, but I guess that's the way things go in ethnic conflicts, that everybody has to take sides.
Now, the refugee population in Batticaloa has nearly doubled recently. Is the system coping?
The most recent influx of refugees has been around 60 to 80,000. That's in the last month, and it was over a period of almost just a week. So it was this massive influx, and they filled schools, they filled churches, as well as the existing camps. So this entire district has been overrun by refugees. But for now, they're getting food, they're getting water. It's not a comfortable existence by any stretch of the imagination, but they're surviving. But the problem now is that the World Food Programme have said that the food supply they have is going to run out by the end of April unless they find more means of funding. So what we're looking at is a situation that is close to stable now, but within a very short period, it could deteriorate very quickly.
I was fascinated by the point you made about the place of education in Sri Lankan society and the way the schools, even amongst the refugees, have restarted so quickly.
Yeah, and as I said in the article, it's almost something that they're very well practiced in doing. That's because Sri Lanka has had so much conflict and disaster in its recent history, that education is very important, because once these kids start to lapse in the education, once they start to miss 3, maybe 6 months out of the education, it becomes very hard to catch up. And if you don't go to addressing that problem, what you end up with is entire generations and geographically specific populations that's become completely disempowered because they basically drop out of the education system and have no opportunities for employment, and then you would have an entire generation of people that are very bitter and angry at the system. So this is why education is extremely important. And what they do is because their teachers are fleeing along with the students, they can set up schools, they have the teachers there, and they can set up camps and set up basically sheds and hold schools within two weeks of the refugees arriving. Of course, what they need is they need books, they need stationery, and they need all that stuff, which NGOs as well as groups like UNICEF are helping to provide with the help of New Zealand Aid Money.
The cruelest thing seems to be that some of these people driven from their homes were still just rebuilding after the tsunami.
Yeah, I talked to this one man who said that he had just recently finished building his house with the help of tsunami aid money, and his house was destroyed by the recent artillery bombing. So you've got these communities that have been destroyed and then rebuilt and then re-destroyed. But this time around, they're not going to be as lucky in terms of getting the international aid. They're going to have to do it themselves, and it's going to be a much more difficult road.
Now, just finally, it's been pointed out that our own Fonterra can hardly be separate from all this, given its huge stake in the Sri Lankan dairy industry. Are there any relevant questions over its conduct?
No. The country is quite, the conflict, in terms of the active conflict, is quite limited to the northern eastern parts of Sri Lanka. What you see in the other parts of the country is more what you would call terror tactics. So it's Fonterra doesn't operate in any of the in the actual conflict zones, so it doesn't really take a direct part in the conflict. But in a way, what you'd be looking at is the actual Sri Lankan economy that's being extremely stressed at the moment. It's got inflation running at 13%, and its foreign exchange is going down. It was kind of kept up by the influx of foreign capital after the tsunami. But now that that money has been exhausted, it could be facing a lot of troubles up ahead. And Fonterra, of course, as the kind of products that it provide in terms of the luxury dairy products would probably be in trouble. But it still has its basic sort of milk powder produce that probably won't be affected too much.
Keith Ng, for looking somewhere where the rest of the world isn't, thanks very much. We'll see you back here sometime.
Thank you, Russell.